Good morning. My name is Joseph Huff. I'm a public defender and I represent Corey Albert. My registration number is 34384. As unlikely as it seems, I'm going to try to get to all three issues if I can, but of course we're limited by 15 minutes, so I'll jump right into it. And I'm going to go in order here. So the first issue that I raise in my brief is sufficiency. And the reason I think this is important, even if you don't agree that the evidence was insufficient, clearly the evidence was fairly weak on intent and deliberation, and that certainly factors into the harm analysis of the other two issues. But I want to argue why the evidence was insufficient to substantiate first-degree murder. As this court knows, the standard is in the light most favorable to the prosecution, but it's also substantial and sufficient. And in this case, because it required deliberation, it required exercise of reflection and judgment, it can never be, according to the statute, hasty or impulsive. And this is a case that I'm saying was hasty and impulsive, and I think the evidence bears that out. For instance, there was no overt hostility or threats by the two parties. They were actually friends. There was no motive. My client didn't steal anything from the victim. He didn't ensure that the victim had died. He didn't even know that the victim had died until well after he was apprehended. He didn't pursue the victim. He didn't incite the victim or the witnesses to violence. He was under the influence, clearly, of some substance, as stated by the prosecution's sole eyewitness. He appeared high or drunk or both, according to the witness. He showed ample remorse in his statement that he gave to the police. The sole eyewitness for the prosecution indicated that he was sketchy. When the van pulled by, he became sketchier than he already was. He was on edge. He said that he acted out of instinct, out of impulse, because he believed that the victim was going to shoot him. He said the victim had earlier told him, "I'm strapped," meaning I have a gun. And when he went back to the car, the victim leaned out the window and said, "Here you go." And he thought that the victim was pulling a gun on him, and he instinctively and impulsively shot. Yes, ma'am.
Counsel, why doesn't the victim's statement that he's strapped, meaning that he's armed or carrying a weapon, why didn't that create some sort of animosity or at least some sort of mistrust between, you know, these two people that you say were friends?
I think it certainly did, but I don't think it's dispositive, and I think it actually shows why my client got the gun in the first place and returned to the scene. It wasn't to go kill the victim. He had no reason to kill the victim. It was purely in his own self-protection because the victim informed him, "Look, I'm going to be strapped. I'm going to have a gun." So my client went back and also got his gun, but there was no indication that he ever intended to use it for anything other than self-defense.
But, I mean, just going to get the gun, why doesn't that show some sort of reflection in contrast to this hasty impulsiveness that you're talking about?
I mean, because I believe the evidence showed that he retrieved the gun purely for defensive purposes, not offensive purposes. I don't think there's any evidence in the record that there was any motive for him to shoot the victim other than that he felt threatened immediately in the moment and it was a hasty response.
What about the fact that he owed the victim money?
Well,
the victim was there to collect it.
He just could have not given him the money. He could have just not returned. I think he fully intended to pay the victim the money. And I don't think he went there to kill the victim so he wouldn't have to pay $250. If he didn't want to pay $250, he just never would have gone back to the car in the first place. But I believe, and the evidence shows, that he went back to pay the debt and was going to, or at least partially the debt, but then was caught off guard, was caught by surprise at the victim's furtive movements, and the van, for whatever reason, excited him. And he acted in the moment.
Counsel, let me ask you about the van.
Yes,
according to the other fellow who was in the car,
yes, ma'am,
his testimony was that they watched the van proceed around the corner before the shot was fired. Doesn't that support an inference that he didn't want to fire until the van had cleared the corner?
It could be construed that way, but I think from the record, it's clear that for whatever reason, he didn't intend to shoot him. He didn't. Otherwise, if he didn't want any witnesses, he would have killed the victim, too. So I don't think it's an issue of, let's let this van get out of the way so we don't have any witnesses to this crime, or else he would have killed the other witness as well.
Right. Well, if it could be construed that way, and if there's some question about his intent because he could have killed the other victim, isn't that ultimately just a question for the fact finder?
It is, absolutely. And it is a fact. But I think it's a fact that could cut either way. And the courts here is doing a de novo review of all the facts of the case, and certainly that fact could cut against us. It could also be a double-edged sword in the sense that it inures to our benefit because the witness said that this van, for whatever reason, excited Albert, made him more frightened, more sketchier than he already was. So I don't think that, at least viewing the evidence, that he was waiting for a witness to get off the scene. Like I said, if he wanted to leave no witnesses, he would have just killed the other witness in the car too, which he didn't do. So I'm going to leave it at that and move on to my second issue, which is the suppression of the statement. Now, a lot is made in the Attorney General's brief of the fact that my client said, yeah, in response to the officer's question, are you willing to talk to us? But just saying yeah is not sufficient. I mean, it may be sufficient to show that he was willing to talk, but it's not sufficient to show that he understood the panoply of rights that he was waiving by agreeing to speak. Agreeing to speak to someone is far more different than an assurance that they understand the consequences of speaking with you and the constitutional rights they're giving up. In this case, the officers never did that. He quickly rattled off the Miranda rights, never had Albert sign anything, never looked up at Albert and said, do you understand you have a right to counsel? Yes. Do you understand you have a right to stop questioning any time? Yes. He never made any of those confirmations. There was no written waiver. There was no explanation beyond the bare minimum. And as the court found below, as soon as this police officer rattled off all these rights to Albert, who wasn't even really paying attention, if you look at the videotape, he's distracted, he's looking up at the ceiling. As soon as this officer quickly, without any eye contact, rattled off all these rights, they immediately launched into questioning. They didn't even ask Albert, do you agree to talk with us at that point? It was after they had already initiated the interrogation and were a few questions in that one of the officers was like, as a perfunctory matter almost, oh, by the way, are you willing to talk to us? Yeah, I am. But again, just because he was willing to talk to the officers doesn't mean that they got any confirmation that he understood the rights that he was giving up, and he was specifically waiving those rights that he was giving up. It's not equal, it's not tantamount saying, yeah, I agree to speak with you, to say that there was a knowing and intelligent waiver of rights.
Counsel, what authority do you rely upon to support your proposition that more than a recitation of the Miranda rights is required? Because here you're asking us to, you know, effectively require either a written document that he signed or more, because you're saying just reciting the rights is not enough. So what authority supports that?
Well, I think there's lots of Colorado authority. I'll cite People v. Vickery, which is a 2000 Colorado Supreme Court case. It says the waiver must be made with full awareness both of the nature of the rights being abandoned and the consequences of the decision to abandon it. Simply saying yes does not satisfy that. I'm not saying that a written waiver is required in every case. I think it's preferable because it definitely goes into the analysis of whether the suspect was adequately informed of his rights. What I think is required at a bare minimum is that you have to actually ask him, do you understand these rights? And understanding these rights, are you willing to waive these rights? the issue of whether he was willing to waive these rights and whether he actually understood and heard what the officer quickly rattled off was never there. It was simply, yes, I agree to speak with you.
And why shouldn't we take his continuing that conversation, coupled with the fact that, you know, this was not his first offense? He had other criminal proceedings. In fact, I think there was some pending issues in Wyoming that alluded to the videotape. But, you know, it's not his first rodeo, and he's just heard of his rights and continues to speak. So why doesn't the combination of those factors tell us that it was a knowing waiver?
It certainly factors into the analysis that he agreed to speak with the officers. But what I'm saying is, given these circumstances, the fact that he was highly distracted, the fact that he was highly distraught, as evidenced by the fact that he repeatedly asked for his medication, he said he hadn't been given his medication, he was panicking, he was freaking the F out, as he said, those facts, in combination with the fact that the officer quickly rattled off the rights without making any sort of eye contact with Albert, and never got from Albert an affirmative statement that, yes, I do understand I have those panoply of rights, and yes, I am willing to waive them. That's not the same as I'm agreeing to speak with you. And they don't have to have a written waiver in every case, but if they have one, it's certainly evidence of the fact that they understood the rights that they were giving up. There was no assurance of that in this case, and that's my point. Moving on to the third issue, the supposed res gestae. I don't even think this is an issue that this was not res gestae, and all you have to do is defer to the trial court's findings of fact, and I'll read those real quick. He said, this is wholly, completely, and entirely unrelated to anything dealing with this crime. It sounds like an argument we would make, but this is the court saying this. There's an inference of bad character, the court says. The probative value does not outweigh the danger of unfair prejudice, the court says. And this is primarily character evidence, the court says. Contrary to all those statements, which sounds like an argument right out of our playbook as to why this shouldn't come in, the court then says, yes, it's res gestae. It may not be 404B, but it's res gestae. But the court apparently didn't realize that in order to be res gestae, it has to be both relevant, which he said it wasn't, integral part or part and parcel, inextricably intertwined with the offensive issue. And the court basically said it wasn't wholly, completely, and entirely unrelated to anything dealing with this case. I can't put it better myself. That's clearly a statement that this was not intertwined with anything having to do with this case. And furthermore, not only does res gestae have to be relevant, which the court found it wasn't, but it can't be overly prejudicial. And the court also found that it was overly prejudicial.
Counsel, assuming that we agree that it was error, how was it used against him to prejudice the defendant?
Well, it was prior criminality. And I cite the Rincon case. And in that case, this court also found that it was erroneous. However, it was harmless. But I think this is much worse than the Rincon case, because it was repeated. It was fairly specific. It was an inference that the Wyoming court had already determined that he was involved in felony drugs.
But there was a warrant, but it's a little different from a conviction.
Well, that's true. But also the fact that he was caught in another state, presumably attempting to flee justice. And I agree, the prosecution didn't make much hay of this in closing, but I don't think that matters, because this court and our Supreme Court has continuously held, and I'll read from Adams, that's the Court of Appeals case, 1985, the implication of prior criminality cannot ordinarily be considered harmless. And that was reaffirmed in Novotsky in 2003 by this court.
Counsel, did either the prosecution or the defense suggest or request that the examination be redacted to remove the references to the Wyoming proceedings?
Well, I don't believe so, because we asked that no evidence of this would come in the first place. When the court rules against us, it becomes a moot issue then, if the court's allowing this evidence in to begin with. I'd like to stay the rest of my time for rebuttal, if that's okay.
Sure, you can. The 20 seconds, sure.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. Before I get started, I just wanted to draw this court's attention to the fact that the victim's mother, Ms. Janice Lathrop, is here with us in the courtroom. I will do my best to touch on all three subjects, and if this court has any questions, please, I'm at your disposal. I will start, as my opposing counsel did, with the first issue and just work my way through. There are, in terms of sufficiency of evidence, there are, at minimum, at least four reasons to affirm the defendant's conviction for first-degree murder that establishes that he acted intentionally, deliberately, and after reflection. Those four are the existence of evidence of hostility between the defendant and the victim, which, by several accounts, including his DVD interview, talked about an escalating hostility over the course of the day. Two, the defendant used a deadly weapon, and not only did he use a deadly weapon, but to your point, I believe Judge Morris, he went and retrieved that gun in order to use that deadly weapon. Three, the defendant shot the victim at close range, and he did so multiple times, which required a distinct effort to pull the trigger again, again, again. And fourth, something that opposing counsel didn't touch on, except to say that the defendant never had to come back, is that the defendant called the victim back. He called the victim back saying, I've got your money, I would like to pay you off, when in fact he didn't have the money. He never supplied the money, and the victim never retrieved the money. He had to call the victim back, who had already left the scene, and say, come back, I'm ready to give you your money. Now, I also want to talk about that van, because I think what we're talking about is when he watched the van go by, and they watched it drive by, turn the corner, and disappear out of sight, and then, and only then, the defendant take out the gun and fire three times into the car. The opposing counsel admits that it could be construed that the defendant waited until the van left in order to fire, and that's the way this court does have to look at it in this case. Even though it's a de novo review, it's still a de novo review in the light most favorable to the prosecution. In the light most favorable to the prosecution, that is a very strong inference that the defendant waited until the van was out of sight. With respect to the hostility, the defendant and the victim had been spending time together that day, and over the course of the day, they began arguing more and more to what apparently escalated to an actual physical confrontation. I can't speak exactly to how much of that confrontation occurred and over what course of time. There was certainly a period of time where the victim went and spent time with the person that being the eyewitness in this case, Mr. Snow. And at that point, they decided the victim needed to call the defendant and talk to him and reclaim his money. And at that point, the confrontation escalated a little further, a lot further. If there are no questions about the sufficiency issue, I'm going to turn to the...
Counsel, I do have a question. How sure. Do you respond to the defense's contention that, that yes, although the defendant did retrieve a gun, it was only intended for use defensively, that he never intended to use it to commit a murder?
The evidence doesn't suggest anything to the fact that he needed to use it for self-defense. The victim might have said, I'm strapped, so you better not be, or you better be, depending on whose testimony or statements you believe. But there was no evidence that the victim made any sort of aggressive move besides, maybe, here you go. But even that happened right when the defendant got back there. And one of the factors that we look at, and the case law is well established and cited in my brief, is that if a defendant uses a gun and goes to get a gun and repeatedly uses a gun, you have that inference of taking that time to think about it and to take that time to have that reflection. And in fact, even in the case of the defendant cites in his reply brief, People versus Fields, talking about a reasonable amount of time for reflection, that case explicitly identifies two factors, both of which are present here, and that's the evidence of the deadly weapon being used and the evidence of ill will, which we've talked about already. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Michaels, I'd rather that you speed jump to the res jus die at this point.
Sure.
I want to ask you about the court's ruling, and I understand that the court was making the ruling in reference to 404B. But how can the court find that the evidence is wholly and completely unrelated and that the probative value doesn't outweigh the unfair prejudice and not have those same considerations transfer the res jus die?
I think the same considerations were probably there, but I think the court was making alternate findings and it wanted to be very specific why 404B didn't apply. But I think in terms of admitting bad character evidence. In this case, I think it was intertwined. And not one of the two judges found that, which makes it a much higher threshold to determine whether two judges abused their discretion, which is a very high threshold to begin with.
It could be that the second judge just was adopting the first judge's ruling, so I'm not so concerned about the two judges.
Okay.
I guess what I'm concerned about is that even when you have res jus die, you have to consider whether the probative value is outweighed by the unfair prejudice. And I don't know how the court can make probative versus prejudice findings differently, whether the theory of admissibility is 404B as opposed to res jus die.
I think even despite the court's findings, there is relevance to it because it explains why the defendant came down to Colorado, why the defendant didn't leave Colorado to go back to Wyoming, how the defendant knew the victim in the first place.
What difference does all that make really, though? I mean, you can find something to do with something in almost any piece of evidence, but why is that something that the prosecution really needs to prove?
Why is the warrant with the prosecution?
First of all, how does the warrant even show that he came down from Wyoming? Yeah, there's a Wyoming warrant in existence, but maybe he was in Missouri in the meantime or something. See, I'm just not understanding how the evidence of a warrant really establishes any fact that's all that relevant.
I think it only establishes the fact that he's been involved. The issue here was potential drug trade. That was the defendant's theory of defense at trial, that he was trying to buy drugs from the victim.
And he didn't particularly contest that.
He didn't particularly contest that, but just because the defendant admits to something doesn't mean the prosecution isn't obligated to put forth the best evidence they have in order to get that. And now, not every evidence has to be that home run hit it out of the park, but every piece of evidence contributes. In some way towards the ultimate burden.
And so the fact that the defendant may have had an outstanding warrant, which isn't even a conviction, or some evidence of an activity in Wyoming for drug stuff, if that somehow establishes that this transaction was also about drugs, and particularly when the defendant wasn't really contesting it?
I think it goes, I mean, part the contesting part isn't a huge problem because the prosecution, as I said before, it allowed to present its case in terms of even if the defendant concedes an issue, they still need to put forth evidence to establish that fact in order to get their proof beyond a reasonable doubt. In terms of bringing in a Wyoming warrant, I think it's more than just the drugs. It shows why he's not in Wyoming. It shows how he knows the defendant. It shows that she knows the victim. It shows how he knows.
I'm not sure it does show that, because you say, well, this guy's got a warrant in Wyoming. Doesn't it take several inferences to show that that's why he's no longer in Wyoming? I mean, it doesn't really show anything except that there's some suspected criminal activity in Wyoming.
And that he's no longer going to Wyoming. So it suggests why he's down in Colorado, why he's with the victim in Colorado. There was talk at one point, I can't remember if it was in the trial or in the preliminary hearing, that the victim drove him down from Wyoming. And it establishes that the defendant would be in Wyoming otherwise, but this is why he's here. And this is also why...
Well, does it establish that? I mean, he's got a Wyoming warrant. Does that really say that he would, anything about whether he would or would not be in Wyoming or why he came down from Wyoming?
I think it does. I think it suggests that he would be in Wyoming, in his home state, otherwise. Or even if it doesn't, it suggests why he's in Colorado. And perhaps it is just an inference, but it's still a permissible one based on the evidence. And it still explains part of the background motive for the defendant's actions in being here, and for the defendant's association both with the victim and, to a certain extent, with the drug trade. Because he knows how to deal with debts, and he knows that it's not... I think I'm going to stop there. I hope I answered your question. But if you like, I know you had this question from my opposing counsel, I can talk to the harmlessness aspect of it, which I think is absolutely unequivocal that it's a completely harmless issue. I catalog in my brief fairly exhaustively the number of times it's mentioned, and the opposing counsel admitted that the prosecution made no hay of it at all in closing argument. In the video, the Miranda interview, they talk about the Wyoming warrant, but they only talk about it very briefly. And as you pointed out to opposing counsel, the Wyoming warrant, it's not a criminal conviction. It doesn't have that imprimatur of the Wyoming courts. It doesn't have that imprimatur of criminal wrongdoing. It's an accusation. And they know that. A jury's not going to say, oh, he had a Wyoming warrant, therefore he automatically killed this man.
In addition to the reference in the video, was there a reference in testimony by the detective?
There were two very brief references. One was by a Detective Bunger, and the specific side of it is in my brief. But Detective Bunger was the Kansas police officer who first apprehended the defendant and who ultimately transferred him over to the Colorado detectives. I believe it's Detective Wilson. And he mentioned something about we were asked to get him based on a Wyoming warrant and a homicide. And so that's how they were able to quickly mobilize. And that goes to another reason why it was invisible in the first place, because it would have been much more difficult to mobilize an out-of-state police force to arrest somebody on essentially at this point, which was just a charge. They knew he had done it. At this point, they had a slew of evidence suggesting that Albert was the shooter, but they needed to get him before he got out of their reach and got to his ultimate destination in Nebraska. And then Detective Wilson didn't talk about it at all on direct examination, and the only time he talked about it was when he was cross-examined by it, by opposing counsel. And so to the extent that his testimony was damaging, I would suggest that that's something that the defendant brought up himself. And then the video explicitly says, the police officers say, I think it's been three or four times that it comes up, and they say, we don't want to talk about that. We want to talk about the shooting. So they constantly defer our attention away from it. And I also just, I want to talk about that in terms of the facts of this case, it's utterly harmless. But in terms of the law that this court and the Supreme Court in Colorado here has established, it's harmless too. Opposing counsel talked about Rincon. Rincon dealt with facts incredibly more extreme than here. In Rincon, there was the prosecutor came out of nowhere and said, well, what about this drug deal that you did previously with someone completely unrelated? And the issue there was a drive-by shooting. So drug deals had absolutely no place in the discussion there. I cited a few other cases in my answer brief, People versus Fears and People versus James. James comes out of nowhere and talks about gangland associations and criminal activity when the criminal activity hadn't even rise to gangland associations. And Fears talks about a proven crime, I believe, that happens previous to the offense. And in all those cases, this court and the court of appeal and the Supreme Court said that it was harmless, and all those cases presented facts where there was actual proven criminal conduct, unlike here, and facts that were much more severe and much farther dissociated from the criminal action at issue. So I hope that answers your question. I'm happy to talk very briefly about the Miranda issue, or if there are any further questions about either the sufficiency or the Wyoming warrant issue, I'm happy to answer those two. But otherwise, I'll just talk very, very briefly about Miranda. There are four reasons, very strong reasons, that the Miranda waiver was valid and that reversal is not required. The first is that he was advised of Miranda. It was unequivocal. The defendant received his Miranda warnings from the detective. The detective read it off a note card, and contrary to opposing counsel statements, you can see in the video that the detective pauses, maybe just a little briefly, but he pauses after each right and then continues. And when he's done, he asks, do you understand these rights? And all but nods. So he doesn't say, yes, I absolutely understand them. I understand that it will waive every one of my rights down the line. But that's not what's required. And numerous courts have upheld that. The U.S. Supreme Court back in 2010 in Burgess versus Tompkins, and I talk about that in my brief, explicitly says that as long as the defendant understands and does something inconsistent with that right, then that he's waived it. He doesn't even have to say, yes, I will waive that. Yes, I understand that those panoply of rights are gone forever. And they're not gone forever either. Which brings me to the second point, which is the defendant never unambiguously or even ambiguously said, I want to stop or I don't feel like talking. He never said anything. He said just the opposite. I want to help with you guys. I'll work with you guys completely. And that's within the first 4 or 5 minutes. And then the first two questions they ask after reading him the rights are, what do you know about the shooting, or do you know something about the shooting? And he just denies it. That's it. And then the other detective says, wait, we want to make sure you're going to talk with us. And he not once, but twice says, yeah, I do. So in the course of the first 5 minutes, he says 4 times, I want to waive these rights and I want to affirm, essentially. Not in those exact words, but he affirms his right and his understanding. And there's just no police misconduct ever. They were conversational, they were talkative. He knew he was under arrest. And going into the interview, he knew what they were going to talk to him about. He had talked with his family, I believe it was his grandmother back home, and he knew that they were talking to him about the shooting of the victim. The fact that the defendant wanted some Xanax and wanted to smoke a cigarette is not at all an issue in terms of his mental state. He had a Xanax by his own admission 4 hours previously at worst, and that time has expired. So I would ask that you affirm unless there are any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't quite recall the interrogation taking place, as the Assistant Attorney General said, so I'd encourage this court to please go back and review that to know. Finally, as to the harm, look no further than the trial court's findings as to the harm of the race justice. The court found it has an inference of bad character, probative value does not outweigh danger of unfair prejudice, and it's primarily character evidence. The Attorney General just said it shows that he was involved in the drug trade in a case where the jury could have easily convicted of second-degree murder. The fact that the defendant was a criminal out of Wyoming, perhaps fleeing justice, felony drug charge, could very well tip the scales against us and found and had the jury find first-degree as opposed to second-degree murder. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your helpful arguments. This matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course.